From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Think ancient Celts, and you likely think rugged, ragged, red-headed warriors, brave and uncouth and no match for the Roman legions. They're white-robed druids poking in the woods for mistletoe while Romans burned their villages. Well, writer Graham Robb has a different picture, a Celtic Middle Earth long before Tolkien dreamt The Hobbit, stretching far across Europe with a depth and sophistication the Romans simply couldn't see. A pan-European Celtic civilization that extended from Spain to the Black Sea, sophisticated, advanced, and simply on the wrong side of history. This hour on point, ancient Celts and Druids and the discovery of the real Middle Earth. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What's your image of life and culture and knowledge in pre-Roman, pre-Christian Europe? Do you know the story of the Celts? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Carlisle in England is Graham Robb, author, travel writer, prize-winning biographer of Balzac, Victor Hugo, and Rimbaud, author of The Discovery of France, and now of The Discovery of Middle Earth, Mapping the Lost World of the Celts. You'll find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Graham Robb, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Thanks very much, Tom. It's nice to be talking to you again.
The Hobbit, Desolation of Smaug, top of the box office this weekend. So many people have Tolkien in mind when they think of Middle Earth. You're describing Middle Earth in quite different terms, and you're bringing it to us from history, proto-history in some respects, as you call it. What's the Middle Earth that you're referring to right there in your title, Graham?
Well, the Middle Earth, which Tolkien used as the basis of the imaginary world of Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit, was a concept which he took from Norse and Celtic mythology. And the idea of the Middle Earth was that this is our Earth, this is the inhabited Earth we all live on. And beneath, there's the underworld, the lower Earth, and above are the heavens, the upper world. So that's it's simply the inhabited Earth. And for the Celts, the concept of middle worked in three dimensions, because apart from the lower world and the upper world, on Middle Earth, it was vital from their point of view to know exactly where the center of that Earth was. And that concept you can see in all sorts of things like Celtic art objects, but also in the way they arranged their territories and planned their military campaigns.
You look deeply at their mapping of the Celtic terrain, and we'll look at that. I want to get to know this culture to the depth that we can, its leaders to the extent we can. I think today when people think Celtic, the mind goes right away to Ireland. But you describe a much broader canvas than that. Why do we associate Celtic with Ireland today? And what's the broader canvas you're looking at, Graham?
Well, there's a very long history to the Celts. And when we talk about the ancient Celts, we're actually talking about a very diverse group of people. And it's funny because when I started working on the book, people would say, oh, well, you're a Celt yourself because you have dark hair and your parents are Scottish. And I had a German friend who heard this, and he pointed to our mutual friend who's a very tall, blonde, blue-eyed Bavarian. And he said, no, he's a typical Celt. And since then, I heard about a Spanish woman who has red hair and freckles, and she's thought to be a Celt. And in fact, the ancient Celts had no single ethnic trait. They were a culture, which you can see in their language, their religion to some extent, what little we know of it, and also their art. And when we think about Celts today, we're actually thinking about much, much later historical development, and especially the Anglo-Saxon invasions of Britain, which pushed the old Celtic peoples out to the fringes, to Wales, to Cornwall, to Scotland, and to Ireland. So there's a great sweep to the history of the Celts.
So when you look at the Celtic world, in your mind's eye, you're seeing something that stretches from literally the western shores of Spain in a big arc across Europe all the way to the Black Sea, to Turkey.
That's right. They did, and this was at quite an early period. We're talking about 300 BC. And if you remember the Bible, St. Paul's epistle to the Galatians, those Galatians were called Galatians because they were descended from Celtic immigrants who had come all the way across the Alps from Gaul. And as you say, at its widest extent, the Celtic world did cover most of or all of what we think of as Western Europe, all except for the northern parts of it. And it wasn't really an empire in the Roman sense. It was this Celtic culture which spread by dissemination, by migration, sometimes by invasion, but it wasn't primarily an empire that was created by military conquest.
I want to understand that culture better and the way it saw that large terrain. But let's understand the hardware kind of here first. I mean, they weren't an empire like the Roman Empire, but the Roman Empire definitely cut into their domain, that culture. In many ways, you describe the oncoming Romans as vanquishing them, scattering them, Ireland ending up, Great Britain first, or the Isles, and then Ireland as a last redoubt.
Yes, well, actually, the Romans never conquered Ireland, although the general Agricola, who conquered most of northern Britain, wanted to cross over the Irish Sea and take Ireland.
But I guess that's my point. That's where the cults almost ended up in retreat.
Yes, they were by that time they were in retreat, because the Roman expansion was in many cases a deliberately genocidal campaign against the Celts. And if you read Julius Caesar's very detailed account of the Gallic War, how he conquered Gaul and also invaded Britain, he does say at several points that a particular tribe was wiped off the face of the earth. He would mutilate the male members of a tribe or simply massacre a tribe and sell the rest into slavery. So, and in fact, it's something of a miracle that Celtic culture survived to the extent that it did, not just in Britain, but also in France.
So you're talking of a sweep of time here from something like, 800 before the Christian era, BC, BCE, yeah, all the way to 300-500 on the other side of that demarcation, way back before the Romans. The ancient Greeks traded with them in what we'd now call Marseille, maybe beyond as well, and called them Celts.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? Well, that's actually the first time that the word Celtoi came up, because long before there was a Roman Empire, when Rome was just an insignificant settlement on the Tiber, Greek traders arrived in the northern Mediterranean and bought land from the local Celtic tribes. And as you say, Marseille, or Massalia as they knew it, was the first big Greek trading port. And that was how classical culture reached the Celtic world. Greek science, which we can actually see on the ground in the form of these huge land divisions called centuriations, which the Greeks established. And that relationship seems to have been quite peaceful. It was a trading relationship. The Celts were extremely fond of red wine, which they at first bought from the Greeks and later from the Romans. And the Greek traders, and then eventually the Celtic traders, moved further and further inland until eventually, still before the Roman Empire, they were crossing all of Gaul, all the way up to the English Channel, and probably crossing over into Britain.
You describe a great migratory route from the southwest of Spain, right up on a kind of solstice line through the Pyrenees, Andorra, right up into the Alps, a migratory way that Hannibal himself, you are asserting here, likely followed when he came up from North Africa in his attempt to invade Rome.
Yeah, it sounds very implausible, doesn't it? And when I first realized that this route, which Hercules was supposed to have taken in legend, all the way from the end of the earth, as they knew it, the extreme southwestern tip of the Iberian Peninsula, through southern Gaul and across the Alps, when I realized that there were real places associated clearly with places mentioned in the legend where the gods had fought Hercules' enemies and so on, where he had set fire to the Pyrenees and blasted his way through the Alps, creating the pass known as Mont Genèvre. It did seem unlikely that this had some connection with the real world, But when you look at the accounts, and there are very detailed accounts of Hannibal's crossing of Gaul and the Pyrenees and the Alps with elephants, you can see that he was trying to present himself as the successor to Hercules. Now, Carthaginians had their own avatar version of Hercules. The Celts, too, saw Hercules as the founding father, the progenitor of all the Celts. And so this was a route on which travellers were supposed to be safe, but which had an enormous amount of legend and mythological prestige attached to it. And that's why Hannibal, who needed to get the Celtic tribes on his side as he marched towards Rome, that's why he took this particular route, which was the route of a god. And of course, he couldn't just follow it in a straight line. Only gods can cross the country in a completely straight line because they can blast their way through mountains. But wherever possible, he would adhere to that line. And the crucial thing about Hercules was that for the Celts and the Carthaginians, we know from some ancient Greek texts, was also a sun god. And the fact that this line is oriented on the rising sun of the summer solstice was hugely significant to the Celts.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the real Middle Earth of Iron Age Europe's Celts and Druids long before Tolkien dreamt his hobbits and the world as they knew it and drew it. Graham Robb is with us. His new book is The Discovery of Middle Earth, Mapping the Lost World of the Celts. You can join us. How do you picture Middle Earth? What do you associate it with culturally, historically? Did you know that Celts lived over nearly all of Europe in their heyday? And have you pictured yourself a druid? What do you think that meant? Can you picture the culture across Europe before the Romans? We're at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Graham Robb joins us from Carlisle in England. And all that music, for anyone who's seen the movie, and so many have, you know, brings to mind these sort of very tidy cottages set into hillsides. What do we know about, and it must be very diverse given this the span of geography that you have them spread across, Graham, about the way these people lived? It's they didn't leave stone ruins like the Romans.
Exactly. Yeah, and if you want your civilization to reach posterity, you should definitely build in stone rather than wood. And the Celts mostly built in wood. But thanks to new archaeological techniques, especially in the last 10, 20 years, we do now know quite a lot about the way they lived in their towns. And structural archaeologists have shown that some of the wooden mansions of the Celts were greater feats of engineering or carpentry than many Roman or Greek temples. And we also know from contemporary Greek writers, ancient Greek writers, who went to Gaul to find out how the Celts lived, that they lived quite comfortably. And there was one writer that I always think of when I see Celts depicted in movies or spattered in mud and blood and looking extremely untidy. Mm-hmm. He said, "You will never see in all these lands a man or a woman, however poor they may be, either dirty or in rags." And it's hard to think of a country in the world today about which you could say that. Now, you might have been exaggerating slightly, but we know that they did have comforts. They had very well-insulated homes. A lot of them had wine. Even in Britain, they had wine, and they also sometimes snacked on Mediterranean olives. And their towns, which they oddly, from our point of view, built on the top of hills, had magnificent, beautiful walls made of stone with huge tree trunks inserted between the stones. And it used to be thought these were built for defense. But experiments have shown that actually they were quite weak. They were very easy to burn and also to topple with a battering ram. And it now looks as though they were built that way because they looked nice. And that seems to be quite a Celtic trait.
Give us some sense of the Roman depiction of Celts that's come down to us, how they describe the Celts, and maybe some of the motivation for the description.
Yes, the Romans really gave us our view of the Celts as mud-smeared barbarians. And one reason they did that was that they were afraid of the Celts. Every Roman knew that in 387 BC, a Celtic army had marched into Rome and plundered it and massacred a lot of its citizens. And that was why the Romans remained afraid of the barbarians from beyond the Alps. And actually, some historians say that if it hadn't been for the Celts, the Roman Empire would never have expanded, because when they invaded Rome, the Celts had moved into northern Italy and colonized it. And that's why a lot of the names of towns in northern Italy, Milan, Bologna, Brescia, Turin, all come from Celtic words. They were the Celtic names of Celtic towns. And not only that, but the Romans had been terribly impressed by this superior civilization, which had such technically advanced chariots and carriages, that they abandoned their own contraptions and adopted the Celtic technology. And that's why almost every word in Latin for a wheeled vehicle is actually a Celtic word. It came from the Celts. So later, when Julius Caesar in particular started to massacre Celtic tribes, and there were Roman citizens who thought his approach, as Pliny put it, a crime against the human race, it was important for him to say, well, they're not civilized people anyway, it doesn't really matter, we should just march in and take their wealth and use them as slaves. So a lot of the view of the Celts as barbarians, which is still a romantic view that we have, does owe quite a lot to Roman propaganda.
Now, make the case a little more deeply, if you would, that this is deserves one kind of umbrella identification with the whole thing. I mean, you write, the Celts were a group of cultures, not a race. They spread rapidly from Central Europe by influence and intermarriage as much as by invasion. But they're spread over such a wide territory. I mean, you're putting, what today we'd look at as Spain and France and parts of Germany, way into Central Europe, all the way over into the Balkans, not to mention the British Isles, all under this umbrella. Make the case that they have recognized one another as a common civilization?
Well, they were recognized by other peoples, by Greeks and Romans, as a common people. I mean, you're absolutely right. We shouldn't exaggerate the similarities, because there was huge diversity, and that's reflected in the archaeology. And I was concentrating in the book mostly on Gaul or France and Britain. But the elements of cohesion that we know about were, in particular, the language. Now, today, for example, Welsh speakers don't necessarily understand Breton speakers, although they're both speaking a form of Celtic. And we can assume that was probably the case in the Iron Age. There wasn't necessarily mutual intelligibility. But we do know that the languages that were spoken in southwestern Spain and then way over beyond the Alps did belong to a group of languages that we call continental Celtic. And perhaps the most obvious similarity is Celtic art, which is instantly recognizable. It has certain labyrinthine geometrical forms, which do suggest a kind of common culture. And I think the thing that confused the Romans was that even though these tribes did have separate identities, they showed an alarming ability to form huge alliances. And this is what constantly troubled Caesar when he marched into Gaul, that all of a sudden, instead of just facing one tribe, he would be facing a huge coalition with an elected leader. So you're right, we shouldn't exaggerate the similarities, but we can also be struck by the cohesion of these different Celtic peoples.
Graham Robb's new book is The Discovery of Middle Earth. Let's hear from our listeners. Mike in West Palm Beach, Florida. Thank you for calling, Mike. You're on the air. What do you see?
I'm very happy to hear this discussion going on, and I would like to tell you that the Celts won. We're still speaking Irish, Gaelic Irish in Western Ireland, Scottish Irish, Erse up in the Highlands. You're still speaking Welsh in Wales, the Gaelic. Galatians are still speaking a little bit of the Galatians. Manx are still speaking their Manx language, which are all Celtic languages, and no one speaking Latin unless you're a doctor or an attorney. So I'm very, very excited about this program. And the Celts have been a major influence. And unfortunately, history is written by the winner. And Julius Caesar in his Punic Wars basically described the destruction of the Celtic culture very well, I think.
Yeah, Mike, thank you for your call. Graham Robb, there it is, Celt pride.
Yeah, that's, well, actually, you'll be happy to know that a lot of historians, especially French historians, but some British historians, now talk about the Roman interlude. Instead of, you know, the old story used to be that civilization began in France and Britain with the Romans, and historians now tend to stress the continuity, which you've just pointed out, in which, in that huge time period, the Romans were just an interlude. And of course, the contribution of Roman civilization was absolutely enormous and very noticeable.
I would say Latin has had a pretty good day over the centuries.
Well, of course, Latin survived in various modern languages,
yes,
Italian and Romance languages, France, yeah. French and Spanish.
What about the leaders, if that's the right word, in this Celtic world you describe? You call the Druids the priests or scientists of the Celts. But here's one listener on our website. Rolo writes, no one knows what the Druids thought nor the true nature of their religion. It's gone into the void. All the stuff you see in the Celtic nations and the festivals and such, our listener writes, are just conjurings of ad men.
Yeah. Yes, that's true. And this is partly why academic archaeologists are still reluctant to write about the Druids. I mean, in Britain, 2 days ago, a lot of people dressed like Victorian illustrations and calling themselves Druids gathered at Stonehenge in southern England.
For the solstice.
For the solstice, yes. Well, Stonehenge to the Celts would have been a mysterious ancient monument. It belongs to a completely different stage of civilization. It's prehistoric rather than proto-historic. And so that modern infatuation with the Druids has, for academic writers, as it were, contaminated the whole field and made it very difficult to write about. But in fact, we have a wealth of information about the Druids. There are about 20 ancient writers who mention them. And some of the texts about the Druids, in particular Julius Caesar's text, are very, very detailed. And one thing that strikes one is that even though there are references to Druids as weird magicians and fanatics, there are also texts which do describe their 20-year education, which, you know, it's about as long as a modern education from nursery school to a doctoral degree. And it's clear from some of those accounts that they weren't just involved in religion. They settled boundary disputes. They had a political role, as well as religious role. And that's partly why three imperial decrees were issued against the Druids, which is quite unusual.
By Rome, imperial
Empire.
Rome. Mm-hmm.
Yes, sorry, by Rome. And the one of the very few Druids we know by name, Diviciacus, was a friend of Julius Caesar, an ally when he was in Gaul. He was a scholar and a diplomat, and we know this from the orator Cicero, because Diviciacus stayed with Cicero in his house on the Palatine Hill in Rome, and he was one of the very few non-Romans to address the Roman Senate. So Diviciacus doesn't at all correspond to the idea that many people have today of the Druids as weird, hallucinating priests.
A Druid before the Roman Senate, that's a picture. You say that the Druids banned all written expression of their wisdom, you say. Why?
Well, according to Julius Caesar, this was because they used a technique which was used in British schools until quite recently, which consisted of imparting the religious precepts in the form of verse, rhyming verse, which is quite an effective way of giving people information that they'll retain for years. And actually, even in well-run museums, you quite often see this quoted to show that Celtic society was illiterate. But Caesar goes on to say that for all other purposes, other than religion, they used the Greek alphabet. And sure enough, inscriptions have been found all over the Celtic world, very often in the ancient Celtic language, but written in Greek characters. And in fact, it was a very literate society. Archaeologists keep finding writing materials, wax tablets, and other writing implements.
One would have thought that if it were so literate with writing implements everywhere, writing would have flourished. I mean, writing's kind of hard to put down once you start doing it, isn't it?
Well, if it's in the form of wax tablets, it doesn't tend to survive. But a lot of it has survived in the form of stones that were attached to spindles as weights. And these were used as love tokens on which people would write some endearing message. And also on curse tablets, if you wanted to send your enemy to the lower world, you would etch some horrible wish on a lead curse tablet. So those things have survived. And actually, one of the very few complete sentences of the ancient Celtic language that survives says, Natavimpi kurmi da, which means, pretty girl, give me some beer, which does suggest that literate people weren't necessarily high-ranking or particularly well-educated.
Shannon's calling from Cookeville, Tennessee. Shannon, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
I've heard that the Romans were shocked by the freedom and power of Celtic women when they encountered the Celts. Is that true?
Yes, it is. And there are a few descriptions of Celtic women at war. And we know that Celtic armies tended to travel with families. But we also know from several accounts that women weren't just following the army. They were also fighting. And there are various sort of very misogynistic, as you'd expect, descriptions by the Romans of these ferocious, thick-necked women raging into battle at their husband's side. But of course, it wasn't just the soldiers. There were also very powerful female political figures like Boudica or Boadicea, who organized one of the most successful revolts against the Romans in Britain. And he was always presented as having rampaged over Britain because of the righteous indignation of a Celtic woman. But it was obvious that since she destroyed the three main centres of Roman power in Britain, it was obviously a very well-coordinated and supplied military campaign. So, yes, that does seem to be the case. And it's also the case that some Celtic societies had a matrilineal tradition, that wealth seemed to pass through the female rather than the male line.
You write about their communication technique, the kind of network of shouts that could send messages across great distances in surprisingly short periods of time.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? That's Caesar once again, who of course had reason to find out about the Celts' communication techniques. He discovered that they could send a message, a complicated message, quite accurately for hundreds of miles using people who were posted in particular, you might call them vocal telegraph stations, who would transmit the message by shouting across the fields and along the boundary lines. And it sounds at first like something you might try as an experiment. And actually, if you do experiment in open country, you quickly find that it's no good just shouting at random and hoping that someone will hear, because sound travels very differently depending on where you are, whether you're on the top of a hill or in a valley. And this was clearly a very stable and well-supported and organized telegraph system. So Caesar's description of it is a description of one of the first significant events in the history of telecommunications.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the real Middle Earth of Iron Age Europe's Celts and Druids, long before Tolkien dreamed his hobbits. And the world they knew, as they knew it, as they drew it for one another. With Graham Robb, his new book is The Discovery of Middle Earth, Mapping the Lost World of the Celts. Let's go to Michael, calling from New Orleans, Louisiana. Michael, thank you for calling. You're on the air with Graham Robb.
Thank you. And this is a topic that's dear to my heart. I'm a jeweler, and I specialize in Celtic motifs. And I've always been interested in how the modern empires, particularly the British Empire, tended to downplay its own Celtic roots in favor of the Roman tradition, I think often as the bolstering the trappings of empire. the Victorians and Georgian English tended to look to Rome for their aesthetics, and yet they had this very, very rich tradition of metalwork right there in front of them from their own indigenous peoples. Even though the periphery was Ireland and Scotland, the English themselves at that time, when they were the Belge tribes under Boudica, they had their own rich metal traditions, as what we see in the Latine culture. And I just want to know how much of that is still going on, or the, or how much of the that sort of treating them as barbarics is still going on in empires elsewhere.
Graham, what do you say?
Well, my parents are both Scottish, but they lived in England, and it's true that there were a lot of silly ideas that people had about the Scots, and which did tend to be associated with the Celts. And some of those ideas have been adopted as positive virtues. I mean, especially now, where I live at the moment is right on the Scottish border. And with the question of Scottish independence coming up, Celticness is waved quite a lot as a banner. And there's a sort of positive adoption of the Roman view, really, of the hooligan element of the Celts. But I must say, I'm absolutely delighted to talk to a jeweler, because one of the best examples of the sophistication of Celtic culture is their metalwork. And some archaeologists, there's one in particular in Oxford who's a metallurgist, who has shown the skill and the technology that it would have taken to produce a lot of their objects. They worked a lot in gold, which is very volatile metal, and some of the techniques they used still haven't been rediscovered. And actually, the best way, since you can't go and look at a stone Celtic temple, one of the best ways to get an idea of that Celtic sophistication, which was ignored by the Romans, is to go to a museum with a digital camera so you can magnify the object and just peer at the intricacy of those beautiful designs. And if you're of a mathematical bent, you'll notice that a lot of their objects were based on very precise geometrical ratios, but often you're only shown one small part of the pattern, but you can extrapolate the whole geometric pattern and see how that curious design was originally produced. So I think in your profession as a jeweler, there's the proof of the superiority in some ways of the Celts to Roman civilization.
Michael, in New Orleans, when it comes to folks dressing up as Druids, Graham Robb says that, you know, they probably got it all wrong. Do you feel confidence? I mean, when we go to fairs and crafts fairs and beyond, when you're doing your jewelry work, that you're delivering us something really Celtic and not, you know, a latter-day imagination of what it might have been?
Well, what I find is, in the Americas, people crave a connection with the old world. I mean, we're a relatively young country, and our sense of history is disconnected from Europe by an ocean. So you don't have Stonehenge lying in your backyard, as it were. And since they're craving it, the idea of fantasizing it and bringing it back to the fore, it's an important role. I live in New Orleans, where, you know, costuming during Mardi Gras is an important part of it. So what they're treating the Druids is an archetype, a very valuable archetype that is missing in our society to a certain extent. So
right.
If it's a reinterpretation, I don't look upon that as a negative.
Michael, yeah, I appreciate your call. If I may, let me get Peter on from Boston right here. Peter, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hello.
And, great topic. I'm a Boston Irish, proud of my Celtic origins.
Great.
However, that being said, I think we kind of, I don't think you ought to minimize the Druids. They were a bloody lot. And the ones that kind of led the tribes, the Druids, they were every season, every quarter, they were sacrificing people left and right. I let's not minimize what they would do. And in fact, my recollection when I read Tacitus or Agricola, when the Romans, I think it was conquered under Claudius, when they finally had the Druids capture, set off in some island, Anglesa, they have all kinds of archaeological digs that they kept sacrificing more and more people to give them a victory. And I just think that that shouldn't be grossed over, that the Druids, you know, I don't know how...
Don't get on the wrong side of a Druid, you're saying.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to have been in a village when the Druids came in and said, hey, let's take these 15 kids and sacrifice them.
Peter, I'm glad you raised it right there. What about a human sacrifice and the Druids, a bloodthirsty lot? Peter says be careful about, shining it up too high.
Yeah, he's right to mention that that passage in Tacitus, but it's Tacitus says that the Druids had bloody altars, and that when the Romans finally conquered the Druid base in Anglesey, the island off the northwest coast of Wales, they did find evidence of human sacrifice, and there are other sources that suggest that they did go in for human sacrifice. But it's important to remember that on that occasion, the Romans then massacred all the men and women that they found there. And I know I'm going to regret saying this, but we are talking about a very remote age, much of which is strange beyond our comprehension. And human sacrifice as a religious rite, which was sanctioned by a particular society, isn't quite the same as brutal murder. It can still be seen as a mark of savagery and barbarism, but it is important to distinguish it from deliberate cruelty.
Make the distinction for us. What would the substance of that distinction be?
Well, it looks as though for the Druids, human sacrifice performed the function that sacrifice often does in religions. It was supposed to propitiate the gods and to obtain for the tribe something that it needed. And I think it's important to contrast that with the genocidal strategy of the Romans, and also to see that there is a certain amount of Roman propaganda in stressing this aspect of Celtic society.
But you're not denying that it was there.
No, it clearly was there. Mm-hmm. Yes, there's quite good evidence of it. Mm-hmm. Although a lot of the archaeological evidence in the form of bodies found in peat bogs is, it turns out, quite ambiguous. And of course, in this respect, we are prisoners of the texts, most of which are Roman. But, there's no doubting that there were barbaric sides to this society. But we can also see it as an indication of these huge areas of darkness that we can't really penetrate, the aspects of Celtic society that we'll probably never completely understand because so much is missing. Mm-hmm. But your caller is certainly right to point that out, that they did go in for human sacrifice.
Wow, genocide or human sacrifice, pick your poison there. Heidi writes to us on Facebook, says many of the rites and practices of Celts were adopted by Christians in their campaign to unseat the Celtic religion. Many dates also co-opted winter solstice, Christmas, spring equinox, Easter. What about that observation, Graham?
Yeah, exactly right. There are a lot of very obvious similarities between early Christianity and Celtic religion. Just to give one example, Bridget, who's the female patron saint of Ireland, has the name of a Celtic goddess, and her feast day is the same day as one of the four great Celtic festivals. And some of the early accounts of her life say that she herself was the daughter or the foster daughter of a Druid. And actually, even in some of the early Christian ceremonies that were performed by the Irish and Scottish saints, who were actually called Druids, resemble Celtic ceremonies. For example, they would process sunwise in the direction of the sun around a new church or a consecrated well. So there are certainly a lot of analogies, very direct analogies, between Christianity and Celtic religion.
Like your Celts heading across Spain and southern France toward a gap in the Alps. Justin in Salem, Massachusetts. Justin, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I just wondered if Mr. Rob had any thoughts on the controversy between Pelagius and Augustine. There's some suggestion that Pelagius was raised in the tradition of British Druidism and represented a point of view that was much more egalitarian, much more in favor of women, believed in free will and had a much more positive view of the body, as opposed to Augustine, who had a dim view of the body and women's role in the church. And Augustine saw to it that Pelagius was declared a heretic and ultimately executed, I think. And there was a triumph then of sort of the Augustinian point of view, which might have been bad in terms of European history and culture. I wonder if Mr. Robb has any thoughts on that.
Graham Robb, the Druid's last stand there in Pelagius?
Well, that's fascinating, and I wish I could say something knowledgeable about it. I'm afraid that's way beyond my area of expertise, but it's certainly true that Celtic culture and Celtic learning survived for a long time, because we know, for instance, there was an important university at Autun, or Augustodunum, in France, and this is well over 1,000 years before the founding of the Sorbonne, and it was seen as an important seat of learning. And like the Sorbonne many years later, it was also a centre of revolt. And there's a Latin poet, Ausonius, who talks of professors at the universities of Bordeaux and Bayeux as members of Druid families. And this is a very long time after the conquest of Gaul by the Romans. So I'm sure there are a lot of direct filiations in early Christian theology.
Paris itself taking its name from Celtic language, you say? Remind us.
Yes, from the Parisii tribe. And that's one of the curious things about Celtic Gaul. Whereas in Britain, towns tended to stay with the Roman name, all the towns whose names end in Chester, although their names to the Romans. Whereas in France, what happened was with the collapse of the Roman Empire, the old tribal names reasserted themselves, which is why the Parisii tribe still has a capital on the River Seine, and the Tyrones live in Tours, and the Rémy live in Reims. And I think it shows how strong those tribal identities remained all the way through the Roman interlude.
Dan in Concord, Massachusetts. Dan, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I have a quick question for Mr. Robb. Mm-hmm. You do a very good job describing the Celts as a culture. My question is whether you include in that culture, as we go east towards the Black Sea, the Dacians, Thracians, Sarmatians, Scythians, or in fact, did those cultures come first and perhaps maybe influence the Celts? Mm.
Thank you, Dan. You described them, Graham, coming out of Central Europe, but what about as things unfolded?
Yeah, that's very interesting. And it's also interesting that some of the Greek writers and Roman writers didn't really know whether the Celts had come from the west or from the east. And Celtic tribes moved about so much that it certainly wasn't a case of Celtic culture simply spreading itself to other cultures and taking them over. There certainly was a great deal of interpenetration of the different cultures in Europe. And without going quite that far east, going just over the River Rhine into Germania, Germany, the Romans, largely because of Caesar, like to think of the German tribes as being quite separate. But we can see from their names that a lot of those tribes had Celtic names. And they also, even though they had a separate culture, there were clearly elements of Celtic culture that the German tribes shared. And Caesar was guilty of a simplification in saying that the Celtic tribes end at the River Rhine. And actually, all through Iron Age, even Bronze Age society, it is very striking how mobile those societies were and how quickly a particular culture could spread. Thanks for mentioning them.
We can take it just that far east, I guess. One more. Matthew in Northborough, Massachusetts. Matthew, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. My question was mostly answered from the last caller here, but it's my understanding that Tolkien took much of his inspiration from Norse and Germanic legends, and I was wondering why perhaps he didn't take more from the Celtic legends, or maybe he did and I just missed it. Can your speaker speak to that? And
sure.
I can take my answer up here.
Thank you. Graham Robb, what can you tell us?
Well, I think the excellent reason for that is that Tolkien was a professor of Anglo-Saxon in Oxford. And can I just mention the fact I studied and taught at his Oxford College, Exeter College, where he was an undergraduate. It's a completely irrelevant point, but I wanted to mention it.
Sure.
So I think he was expressing his own professional interest, and he's a very rare example of someone who was a brilliant linguistician, brilliant historian, and also a brilliant fantasist.
So does it drive you crazy when Middle Earth is more or less in popular culture today been overrun with a Tolkien version, the kind of Anglo-Saxon version?
No, not at all. But I thought it was important to try to reclaim it for the ancient Celts as well.
Yeah, now people are thinking of wizards and hobbits and all the rest.
Well, the ancient Celts didn't have furry feet, as far as we know. But they did have nice hare's wool boots.
Yeah. It's some picture, and complete with a grid thrown over all of Europe. You spent, you were thousands of miles on your bicycle, kind of tracking this down. Is it really there? Can we really see your grid over the continent? Their grid?
Well, I'll just mention one thing, and that's the solstice, which does sound like something that only weird neo-pagans are interested in. But actually, the solstice for the Celts wasn't something mystical. It was a precise physical reality that was very useful in surveying. And those Greek centuriations I mentioned are a well-attested concrete example that these huge grids covering hundreds of square miles were a physical reality in the Iron Age.
In the Iron Age, with the Celts all over Europe, so much of it anyway, and Druids right in their midst, sort of tracking by Graham Robb's telling, the solstice lines and more across most of a continent. Absolutely fascinating. Graham Robb's new book is The Discovery of Middle-earth, Mapping the Lost World of the Celts. Graham, thanks for being with us today. Thank you so much. Good luck to you.
Thanks very much, Tom.
Graham Robb there in Carlisle, in England. Listeners, thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.